I'm going to wait until we are live because we're starting a new program where we're recording the talks, at least some of the talks that happen here, and then putting them on the file on the website so people can download it and listen to it. In fact, we already have a couple of requests for that this evening. Now are we live?
We've been live.
We've been live. So you've just heard that little explanation. This talk is entitled The Pathology of Religious Exclusivity. My name is Rob Schmidt. This is Stuart Goodnick. And we're both with Taiyu Meditation Center, which is the owner of this store, the nonprofit church corporation, which is the owner of this store.
Which is the best meditation center in the entire world, second to none. All other traditions pale in the face of meditation tradition. So we just want you all to understand that before we begin.
Yes, now that we've established that point, we can move on. When I was yesterday, an old friend of the store who has actually spoken here several times, Adam Bulbulia, came in and said that he was very interested in the topic but wasn't going to be able to make this evening because he was going to be out of town. And of course, I was able to tell him that we'll be recording the talk so he could download it later. But his response to the title, The Pathology of Religious Exclusivity, was, oh, that's about fundamentalism, right? And that's certainly one way to interpret that that title, and one way to look at this. But it actually wasn't the first thing that came to mind when I came up with the title. And so we're going to be, I hope, taking a stab at exploring this topic from a number of different angles. And we'll certainly request questions along the way to stimulate that discussion. So if you have something you want to say, just let us know, and we'll look forward to that interaction. So that being said, why not start with fundamentalism? The sort of fundamentalism that Karen Armstrong talks about very eloquently in a book called The Battle for God is certainly an obvious example of the ways in which religious beliefs have been narrowly construed. One of the things that we want to suggest for your consideration tonight is that fundamentalism need not reside only in someone else that we read about, someone else that we hear about, someone else that whose actions we may deplore. But in fact, fundamentalism, in one sense, is something that is present in ourselves, in a certain sense. If you interpret fundamentalism to be this sense of, as Stuart eloquently pointed out at the beginning of the talk, a sense that my way is the real way, and all other ways are either incorrect, the work of Satan. I mean, we smile and laugh at that idea, but of course there are many people, millions, hundreds of millions of people who would in fact subscribe to that position, if not billions of people. Would subscribe to that position. And maybe in a milder form, that my way is the best way. The other ways, you know, you could grade them in a hierarchy. You could say this one's better than that one's better than this one. But the one that I do, of course, is actually the apex of whatever hierarchy you care to establish. So that's a very common human propensity, apparently. And of course, there are writers, and we have books by some of them over here on the tables for you to look at the conclusion of this talk, who assert that in fact in this day and age, when a single individual can cause unimaginable death, suffering, destruction, that it's a very dangerous propensity in the species. That is to say, to the extent that we nurture that or even allow that to arise, we create a context where that sort of thing is, if not promoted, then at least enabled. And I'm sympathetic to that view, but that's actually not what I want to talk about in particular tonight. I at least, and we'll see what Stuart wants to talk about, I at least want to talk about the idea that this propensity for viewing me and what I'm doing, and what my group that I identify with doing, is actually a fundamental issue that we all face in our spiritual paths. Even those of us who are on paths such as, various Buddhist paths. I'll put in a plug here for our own Tayu path and others, where we deliberately cultivate an appreciation for what the other is doing along these lines. Gurdjieff, the founder of the Fourth Way, had a very famous dictum, and that was that the teaching or spiritual practice must be adapted to the time, the place, and the people. In other words, times change. People are differently constituted based on their cultural conditioning, and that changes based on the times they live in, the places they live, etc. If that's true, if Gurdjieff was right about the teaching in this regard, then it seems to me fairly reasonable to suggest that, in fact, no single approach can ever accommodate and serve the needs, the actual needs, of every human being, because we are so differently constituted based on the particulars of our background and the way we've been educated, etc. So, maybe I'll let Stuart jump in here for a moment.
Well, I wanted to ground this framework and this discussion in some examples. Some of these are personal examples, and some of these are more examples out of traditions. But one is that I get a lot of this from conversations we've had with Jim. In the Buddhist tradition, you can see a tendency along these lines in the way that Tibetan Buddhism tends to represent or characterize other forms of Buddhism. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there's the notion of the Vajrayana is the highest vehicle, Mahayana is the great vehicle, and Hinayana is the lesser or the sort of ordinary vehicle. And to a Theravada Buddhist, to have their tradition relegated to Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, is, at best it's sort of infuriating, or just sort of strange, because it seems completely disconnected to their experience of their tradition. And I think that Tibetans in their own tradition got away with this kind of framework for many, many years because they were so isolated from the other traditions. And in fact, references that they might make to particular texts or traditions were based off of absolutely no experience. It was simply an idea or a framework that was set up that continued a certain kind of self-justification. And it's interesting now that Tibetan Buddhism has dispersed across the globe and is being carried on by so many people in different traditions, and those traditions are rubbing up against very active Buddhist traditions, there's some friction as a result of this. And it's interesting, and Jim likes to point this out, and I've seen this in books I've read myself, that you know, the minute you open up a Tibetan Buddhist book, there, before they get into any of the ideas, many of which are wonderful, valid ideas, there's this discourse on why their particular tradition is the kind of the summa of the procession of Buddhism. And that becomes an obstacle for other people, but it's also just an interesting thing to observe, because what's giving rise to that categorization is the very kind of clinging mind and the very kind of identification that the tradition itself is intended to promote a release from. And so that's paradoxical. Why would someone who is integrating this teaching have such a tremendous blind spot? So that's one example. And, you know, as we go along, if you have comments about that, or maybe perhaps you don't agree, we'll be interested in discussing that. Another example I find is in the Fourth Way tradition. And the Fourth Way tradition was originally founded by George Gurdjieff. And it's certainly, you know, this is closer to home for us, because our framework and our language in Tai Chi meditation is more along the lines of the Fourth Way tradition. But the official, let's say, keepers of the flame, as they would construe themselves in the Fourth Way tradition, is the Gurdjieff Foundation, which was, I think, originally founded in Paris and in New York. And so there's a European Gurdjieff Foundation and American Gurdjieff Foundation. And members of the Gurdjieff Foundation pride themselves on their direct lineage to Gurdjieff. So they're students of Gurdjieff, or students of students of Gurdjieff at this point. And what I find interesting about that is that most people from the Gurdjieff Foundation that I've met and had interactions with embody what I would call a certain kind of spiritual smugness, which is almost a singular disinterest in other traditions and a absolute, you know, sort of sense or, you know, feeling or vibration that the tradition that they inhabit is is the right one, or the superior one, or the most correct, or the most effective way. And it's the lack of interest in other traditions and what other people are doing around the lines of spiritual practice that I find unusual, or I find interesting, indicative of something going on that might be other than spiritual seeking. And as I said, emotionally that feels like spiritual smugness, or more here that now than thou, if you will. But it's a sense of I've got mine, or I've got my tradition, and you know, anyone else outside of my circle is doing something that's not particularly interesting. So finally, the third example that I would use is it's a little subtler. Actually, maybe it's not so subtle, but it's a very current now, and that's the what you hear from what you might call neo Advaita Vedanta teachers, people like Adyashanti, or who was it? Who was here? Umi or
Unmani?
Unmani, and it's the attitude or the statement that there is no spiritual path, or there is no spiritual practice. There's some idea that you know, truth or realization is just in the now. You don't have to do anything. You just have to have the right viewpoint or the right framework. Never mind the fact that anyone who says this typically is a product of a long line of actual spiritual practice of some form. But when they represent that all other traditions, or you know, they have no tradition, or all other traditions are somehow unnecessary, that actually is another way of drawing a line. It's another way of sort of creating this separation, or creating this dichotomy of us versus them. You know, you're listening to me. I'm telling you there's no other path. Therefore, actually, we're in the circle of the people who have got it. Everyone else out there who maybe is practicing for 20, 30, 40 years, you know, they've missed the mark. And in some respects, that's more more mischievous because it's subtler, because, you know, it sort of pretends to be, it's self-deceiving because it pretends to be something that it's not. It claims to be a freeing perspective, but actually it's a reification of the very kind of separation that we're speaking about in these other traditions. At least the Tibetans, you know, have an excuse. I mean, they were on a mountain for, you know, 1,000 years. I'm not sure that the Neo-Advaita practitioners have the same excuse, except that it creates it feeds a certain something in ourselves. And that's, please.
Well, I just wanted to comment. I followed a teacher. He wouldn't call himself a Neo-Advaita teacher, but essentially that's what he was. And he was of the opinion that he'd brought forth a form of enlightenment that was new,
mm-hmm.
that was better than anything else that had come before. And, you know, you could talk to him until you're blue in the face and didn't put a dent in it.
Right.
And his idea, and it was just a variation on what you were just talking about.
That's a very common, let me just respond. The thing that comes up when you say that is, or one thing that comes up when you say that, is the observation that often that's the product of someone who has not, who is, in one sense, in terms of having exposed him or herself to a vaster world of spiritual practice, spiritual discourse, etc. It's like the product of someone of who doesn't have a very mature view. Mature in the sense that it hasn't had a lot of other experience. And it's a very natural thing. I think, actually, I even would go so far as to say that it's a natural step for people doing spiritual practice, or almost necessary, to sort of hold sacred something that has worked very well for them, mm-hmm. for them in particular. But the mistake that we would articulate with that perspective is not that it's wrong to feel that way or to hold that view. It's just another view, and it's a particularly narrow one in one sense, mm-hmm. precisely for the reason that it does not admit of the input from all these other sources. One of the things that makes us inclined to give this sort of talk is precisely that the founder of Taiyu Meditation Center, Robert Ennis, was a huge proponent of doing joint talks with teachers from other traditions, precisely so that you could have dialogue between the different perspectives and see what came up. And also for his own students to study other traditions. But very few spiritual teachers in the scene nowadays tend to actually go out. I mean, I know of a few exceptions, and they are notable. But very few tend to go out explicitly and go listen to other, expose themselves to other teachers. The tendency for many is to sort of hermetically seal themselves from other influence. And that's, you know, that's what comes up in response to that. Jim, you had a comment?
When at various points in my journey, I've been attracted to the tendency that you're referring to, because I believe that what I'm doing is the most complete or the most, you know, like the best. And when I look at those periods, I think what was going on in my mind was something like this, that not every spiritual tradition is equally efficacious. And I still would argue that that's the case. You know, that some religions and some spiritual traditions are not very conducive to awakening. You know, and then I would make the leap, so therefore there must be a best one. And there's something wrong with that leap, you know, that doesn't really follow. And I would wonder if you would comment.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment on that. That I think that logic actually makes a certain kind of sense, but the certain kind of sense it is that I would have to qualify the conclusion, which is there may be a best tradition for me. But you can't say there's a best tradition for everybody, because what makes a given tradition uniquely appropriate for you may be a synergy with a teacher, it may be a synergy with a tradition, it may be a product of impressions that you've received such that the representations in that teaching have a particular resonance for you. But for someone else, it could be completely useless or not as effective as another tradition. And so I think that it's when one finds a home in a teaching, it's certainly helpful to honor that, cultivate that, use that energy in order to deepen your commitment. But when the mind starts to then generalize, that's the moment where you start to create separation, or you start to put barriers up and turn the teaching into something that it's not. And so in that sense, I think you can be right, and that may even change for you, because actually I would qualify it even more, which is this particular teaching is the best one, most efficacious for me right now, which is more a characteristic, I think, of your journey. And that can be true for that period of time.
There is a hunger for that which leaves nothing out. There is hunger for inclusion. In fact, I think the search for God is a search for that inclusionary factor. I like saying, for example, I look for the spirituality of conversation. I believe that in conversations is the ultimate spirit, is spirituality. And I challenge you to challenge me. I remember someone once saying that you can't tell it's a circle when you're only looking at a part of it. And everything lives on the circle of the earth, and the circle of the globe, and the circle of creation. And when we're not looking at the circle, then opposites seem to be exclusive of each other. But when we see it in terms of the circle, then we see how everything is a part of the same dynamic, the same picture. So a part of the spiritual quest is implicitly searching for that exclusive notion which includes everything. There's a contradiction between them.
Let me play back and elaborate on what I'm hearing. And that first, you know, you say there's a hunger for inclusion. And I might, in my experience, when I see people hungering for something, and I mean by hunger a kind of an organic habit pattern, I see more hungering for exclusion. That is a hungering for me finding the right or the best or the perfect experience, or finding the best teaching or the optimum experience. And what I find with spiritual practice when it takes root is that hunger can start to fall away, and there's more of an opening to something that's less exclusive. The habit pattern, the mental habit pattern that many people approach practice with is, or start approaching the spiritual path with, is a trying to find that which is the best. And many people are very sincere, and this may play less so, you know, or more so at different times in people's quests, but, you know, trying to find the, you know, the best teacher, being attracted to the teacher that has the most students, finding, you know, the where the action is in the spiritual scene, these are all things that, like it or not, we all find happening in ourselves at one time or another. I certainly know that I did, and but even have to wrestle, you know, when I was became part of a tradition with, you know, whether this is the right one, you know, there's not enough students around, or you know, my teacher's not famous, or you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I my sense has been that there's a there's a natural hunger for a kind of exclusive experience, or being part of an exclusive club, and that's one of the things that is natural about living life from the orientation of egoic existence. And the challenge with, and the paradox of spiritual practice, is that you have to get out of that in order for that practice to deepen, but sometimes the spiritual scene promotes a certain kind of exclusive thinking, which reinforces the very thing that you're trying to transcend out of. And that's the challenge. That's the twist that we're trying to address here tonight.
Well, I just have a question kind of on this theme. Do you think it's sort of inborn, kind of hardwired behavior, you know, as part of human evolution, to identify with a group to the exclusion of others, to feel, you know, this is my tribe, this is my family, this is my tradition, whatever. And
my own response to that is that for the vast majority of people, in fact, that is precisely the way it works. We are animals. We're social animals. We constitute each other. People who come to my talks a lot hear me say this a lot. We constitute ourselves through our relationship with one, our relationships with one another, and it's a completely natural aspect of the existence of this organism to do that. That being said, one of the things that spiritual traditions throughout history have asserted is that there can be something that transcends those particularities. The urge to self-aggrandize, whether this organism or this organism as a group, as part of a group. We get reports of very rarely someone is born and in their teens they suddenly discover that, it isn't just about social hierarchy and making money and becoming powerful and thinking yourself better than other people and making them think that you're better than they are too. It isn't just about that. But those impulses do seem to be part of monkey mind, you know, part of our primate heritage, our mammalian heritage, etc. Nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with them. The perspective that I'll offer for our consideration in response to your question, but also the previous questions, is that, and it's an elaboration of what Stuart was just saying, is that many traditions talk about different aspects of consciousness or the organism, the egoic consciousness versus something else. We might call it non-phenomenal. We might call it the soul. If we were Gurdjieff, we'd say we'd need to create a soul, and can't assume that there's already one in existence. But however you want to characterize or describe that, it's different than the egoic stuff. And that egoic stuff is precisely the sort of thing that you were just describing, that I added to with the description, you know, money, sex, power, you know, hierarchy, these fundamental aspects of this organism are part of this egoic phenomenon that we find ourselves associated with in these lifetimes. The common approach of many traditions is to then try to focus attention directly upon something that transcends that. Our particular tradition asserts that, in fact, to go out, you have to go in first. You have to focus attention upon, precisely upon, exactly these things that are so problematic before you can actually transcend them. But in any event, what I'm going to suggest relevant to this discussion is that egoic consciousness, to put it in New Age terms, is inherently contractive. Okay, it's grasping, and grasping, the act of grasping is contractive. It's pulling in. Okay, and when we feel that need to go to transcend those egoic impulses, that is going in this other direction. So, and individuals are all we're each in a unique and individual position based on our karmic history, you know, our cultural upbringing, et cetera, et cetera. So that at one point, as Stuart was saying, it might be appropriate to bow to Mecca and do whatever is associated with one particular form. At another point, to continue that might be just more constrictive. At one point, though, it could be a vast expansion, a vast movement in a liberatory direction to embrace a certain set of practices. But if we're not going to become frozen, we have to create a way for that non-phenomenal part of ourselves to learn more about our human lives than the ego does. My teacher used to call it it's sort of like a spiritual arms race in yourself. And the thing is that the ego can learn a great spiritual rap. The ego can get very...
extremely good.
Exactly. Very adept at talking about non-egoic goals, methods, and practices. Extremely good. Okay. So the trick is knowing or being taught how to give the food of the impression of this lifetime, of this organism, to the part of ourselves that is not trapped in this egoic space. And that's where the wisdom of spiritual teachers and traditions comes in. That's why we go to teachers. That's why we use the resources of traditions, because they have been developed precisely to do that. But the ego can twist anything to its contractive ends. So that's kind of the dynamic that we're fighting here. It's something that even a person of great spiritual attainment, where it's a situation where even a person of great spiritual attainment can find him or herself stuck. There's a wonderful sutra, and is it the Middle Length Discourses, where the Buddha describes all these marvelous states that can be attained.
Middle Length Discourses, Sutta 36.
Thank you. What's the title of it?
I can't remember.
Oh, darn. The CD-ROM's working pretty good, but not perfect. In any event, it's this there's this lengthy description of all these states that can be achieved by all these wonderful practices that the Buddha and other teachers teach. And you know, finally he comes to this state that is so rarefied and so so extraordinary that it seems like, well, if you could do that, do you really need to do more? But even that can be grasped. Even that can be grasped by the ego, is what I'm suggesting here. And so what the Buddha says is that the solution is non-clinging. He says that, what's the famous phrase? You haven't memorized, I know.
This is the deathless, it is the liberation of mind through non-clinging.
It is the liberation of the mind through non-clinging. And I would say it's to, in my view, that's the mind that encompasses the entirety of the organism, the body and the heart as well. That's that mind. Okay. So, non-clinging. And we, as beings that incarnate in these very material bodies, we need to start where we are. And most of us, unless we've just come from quite an extraordinary lifetime last time, have to take steps to move in this direction. So the problem of religious exclusivity in one sense is the problem of getting stuck in a process that itself is necessary and desirable. But it's like the phrase from Goethe's Faust, Verweile doch, du bist so schön. Wait a while, you are so beautiful. In other words, to be caught in something that's so perfect and not to continue to let go of the egoic grasping. That's the problem.
I would say that one of the allies in this kind of practice then is the cultivation of humility. And we always hear that in the context of spiritual practice, and that's you know, seems like a nice emotion, and people who are humble are nice to hang around with. But it really is very precise, because it's humility that allows us to let go more easily. It's humility that allows us to see when we're clinging to an idea or clinging to making ourselves better or holding on to a particular state, and then being willing to let that go. Because humility moves back from the impulse that wants to assert a separated self that is doing something and holding on to something. And so humility, not false humility, which is sort of like the ego's way of actually trying to co-opt that feeling, but genuine humility is in part the demonstration of that releasing, that demonstration of that ceasing to cling.
And just a quick note here on humility. The one particular sort of scent that I sort of seek out, if there's anything, is a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, it, to be that sort of like a deciding factor that works for me. You know.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a very good point, because a sense of humor, when someone's willing to laugh both at themselves and at the situations, that genuine humor tends to be grounded in a kind of humility.
Yeah, and a certain self-confidence that's really genuine and really founded on something. Again, we can get in all sorts of different kinds of language, you know, about mm-hmm. what that might be for that particular person or particular time, but, you know, it is grounded in something that has a... I'm struggling for a word, but you know.
You've already articulated it very well, and I couldn't agree more.
It's sort of like it's grounded in nothing in particular.
Right, but it's grounded.
Right.
It's really grounded, and that's one of the things that I guess it's the other thing. I guess the difference. different things that I've tried that's also kind of been a deciding factor too. Because it does have an impractical, functional way for me to live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've gone down a couple of rabbit holes that were quite interesting and certainly felt, you know, right at the time, but ultimately didn't lead to something that could be translatable, that was translatable.
Mm-hmm.
Like I saw a certain lifestyle crop up, and I was like, yeah, I guess it's great if you want to have like a whole village take care of you, you could be in that state. But, you know, it sort of, and it was, and it also felt like a choice. Maybe, well, that sounds too ego.
Well, thank you. The point about humor is, I think, is congruent with what we've been saying here, precisely because humor is generally understood to be it's a reversal. It's a sudden shift in perspective.
Or a release of a buildup.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an expansion.
Right. And that release is due to holding something lightly. If someone doesn't have a sense of humor about something, it's because they're just holding on to that perspective and they can't let themselves look at how absurd it is to hold on so tightly to that thing. So sense of humor, I completely agree, is crucial, because that means you're holding something lightly. Which brings me to another point here. I don't want to be misunderstood in saying that I don't think that it's important to be able to hold a practice or an idea or a set of ideas or a set of practices and fully engage and fully experience those things. Quite the reverse. That's the way we learn, by going in, by undertaking the full range of experiences that we can subject ourselves to. But it's the ability at the same time to not totally buy that's all there ever could be. It's fine to... we were talking with Jim the other night about this, and he was saying that in the Zen tradition, there's an understanding that you have to have both great belief and great doubt simultaneously, in one informing the other, one sustaining the other, each sustaining the other.
Right, and one of the things that we're starting to get into now is language, and what we have such triggers in our culture about certain types of language that have everything to do, especially with spiritual traditions, like discipline, like faith, like belief, all of those things just usually conjure up a lot of emotion in a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. That word faith is so problematic in the public discourse right now for a host of reasons.
When we were involved in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, they finally sort of, the teacher finally kind of understood, like, oh, so blind faith. Well, that's silly.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, no, faith is you should question everything very strongly.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
Kathleen Norris was somebody who helped me tremendously with her, because she was very honest and open about her relationship between doubt and faith and belief. It let me, at that time, make a turn that I wasn't... My mind was way behind what was happening.
There's a word that resonates with me that I came across in the Sagardatta Maharaj, is I am that, which is earnestness. And earnestness captures a sense of willing to engage in a hypothesis, which is to put yourself out into in a direction or a practice. But earnestness also means the objectivity to discriminate and to make adjustments when one's confronted with new data. And that earnestness, to me, goes hand in hand with humility, because it's the power that drives us forward, and it's what can allow us to commit deeply to a practice without getting caught. you know, when earnestness is sort of non-egoic, it's more like it comes from the heart. You know, it's like you're opening yourself up and you're putting yourself out and you're taking a risk and you'll pick yourself back up. You don't have to be right. Whereas other more head-centered pseudo-feelings will have us want to be right and then defend our position. And that those are the things that become the stumbling blocks.
Just talking about humility, I've been sitting here reflecting on... We were students of a Tibetan teacher for a while who had very genuine humility. And it was really interesting at the time is I didn't get it at all. You know, he would make a statement, you know, about, you know, how compared to his teachers he felt, you know.
He was not a
good practitioner, and I was like... Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's something in our driven American culture that doesn't really recognize humility as a virtue.
It doesn't serve advertising very well, does it?
No.
Yeah, it's hard to... it doesn't... I mean, we have a culture of self-promotion.
Yeah.
And so humility tends to make one want to be quiet and unassuming. And that's, you know, that's a... You don't get the big bucks that way. That said, particularly in spiritual context, when someone genuinely, you know, has genuine humility and radiates, that does begin to attract attention from people who are genuinely seeking. So, you know, people do seem to, you know, like you look at someone like Thich Nhat Hanh, who, you know, feels and seems like a very humble, earnest practitioner, and, you know, people recognize that. But it takes a while. You know, you're not going to shoot to the top of the charts being humble. That's kind of the slow rise that happens over a lifetime of practice.
The other thing I'll just bring up here is that the thing about liberation is that it necessarily entails not holding on to anything when it's inappropriate to do so, even humility. That is to say that there are times when the most humble teacher must, to be a teacher, embody fully, sort of like a snake putting its hood out or something like that, or a bird expanding its wings, must demonstrate the fullness, the richness, the ineffable energetic presence of the teaching in a way that can be palpable to people in that room. Not listening on the computer, but it doesn't come through that way. But there's or it doesn't come through very well, in my experience. But in any event, there's this quality of lightness, this quality of not holding a tool, but not gripping it compulsively, is the direction we need to cultivate.
I'd like to add, and you raise an interesting point, which is for a teacher to fully embody the teaching, sometimes there has to be a manifestation of energy for communication with someone at a particular place, and that doesn't seem to be like a humble action. And yet... my perspective on that is it's actually an incredibly humble action, because what usually holds people back who are senior practitioners from assuming a mantle of teaching is a false humility, which says, oh, I can't do that, or I can't assume that position. Whereas genuine humility, you know, says, I'm so small, I can allow the universe to work through me, or I can allow the teaching to work through me. And that it's not about me, you know, and my concerns, my false humble concerns about making a mistake or something like that are less important than the necessity of the moment for the teaching to work through me to convey something in this situation. And so that threshold is a very important threshold for senior practitioners to let go and let go of themselves such that the teaching can actually flow through them in a more dynamic way. And that is the essence of humility, that willingness to let go and take a chance.
A line in a prayer that's very important to me, last line in prayer. I thank you, courage and wisdom, for showing us how to let go of separate truths that we hold in separate hearts that keep us apart, so we can find those truths again, only this time together in one heart.
That's nice. Yeah.
Another item, just about humility. Another favorite writing says, feet being put at the bottom of us make a useful contact with the ground as far as getting from here to there is concerned. And humility also being put at the bottom of us, but in a different way, also makes a different kind of contact, but with a different kind of a ground as far as getting from here to there is concerned. It's all about movement, and it's all about the sense that when we stop moving, that we kind of start dying. So it's kind of like an aversion to a kind of a death that requires somewhere along the line that we awaken some kind of a sense of humility just to get moving again where we might have stopped. Humility has something to do with movement on the path, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very much in keeping with what we've been sort of going back and forth on, that humility is what allows us to move forward, that something else is happening when we get stuck. And usually what's happening is there's some sort of crystallization, some sort of clinging on to something or holding on to something. There's a need to be a something, or to, you know, grab on to an idea, or grab on to a perspective, or a belief, or an emotional posture, and that need to be something can be released again by reminding ourselves of humility, which is just letting ourselves go.
So it's the difference between being a thing and being a movement, or being a dynamic.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting that, and that the ourselves are not things. The nature of self is not a thing, and that's the epitome of the Buddhist teaching. The nature of ourself is this ongoing flow, and keeping that flow open and opening that is the way forward. Yeah.
So, to kind of put a flip on this, though. Okay, then how? Okay. Then how do we practice or embody a particular tradition without falling into this little trap of, you know, my way is the best way, I'm one of the sheep, and they're the goats.
Okay, well, here's a model that you could use that I find helpful. Mm-hmm. I think of it like performing a piece of music, or since you spoke of the Tibetan tradition, I've found the Tonka painting tradition, mm-hmm. you know, a wonderful tradition. Very formal, And yet the masters who are masters of that form introduce a fluidity, if you will, or a certain something in their paintings that distinguish them from like a beginning student work. And when you're dedicating yourself to that form, it doesn't really make sense to say, well, this is the best painting tradition. You know, no other painting tradition is the comes close to this. This is the absolute best painting tradition. You're studying a form because it's the attention on that form, and it's an attention on that practice, and it's the bringing yourself back constantly to that dedication. That's the meaning of and the deepening of your practice. The particular form ultimately doesn't really matter. And in that sense, it doesn't make any sense to say that there's a better practice, you know, or, you know, really, it doesn't make sense to say that there's the most efficacious practice, to get back to Jim's original point, because what makes the practice efficacious is the depth that of presence that we bring to it. One example I really love is from the Taoist traditions, that Taoist practices often begin with these very complex rituals, and the people who are engaged in these rituals have no clue what the rituals are about. They're not told what the ritual is about. No one explains that this means this or this means that, or you know, walking in this direction and lighting these number of candles means anything in particular. But you practice the ritual until it becomes so natural in your body that you just embody that ritual. And in that embodying, then, a deeper understanding begins to come forth that is not really represented in some sort of slick set of conceptual words, but it's a kind of a full integration that comes from having dedicated oneself with such intensity into that particular form. And we can do those things, just like artists do those things, without having to say that my way is better, or, gee, maybe there's a different way.
Well, of course that's true, but let's also get real here. I don't know anyone who hasn't done it that way.
Hasn't done what?
Hasn't, at some point, told him or herself, this is the best way. This is so wonderful. It's a natural, I'll suggest to you, it's a natural extension from, wow, this is great, to, wow, this is the best thing ever, to, you have to do it my way. Okay? It's a natural thing for our minds to do. For our hearts even to do. For our bodies even to do. It's hard not to do that. So what we're talking about here is learning a new way to relate to these habits and tendencies that are very difficult to entirely jettison and leave behind us, if we're honest about it. So these things are present. In our tradition, the way we handle this is to be present with them. That is to focus an impartial meditative attention upon these habits and tendencies, and not to deny their existence. The act of doing that within one's consciousness creates a separation from, a little bit of separation, from the full identification with that tendency. And then, if we're paying attention to the effects of what we do, of the effects of, you have to do it my way, and then we run into, oh, they're doing it their way, and they seem to be doing just fine. In fact, maybe they're doing better than me. What's going on here? You know? There's always somebody smarter than us. There's always somebody prettier than us. There's always somebody stronger than us. You know? Being willing to see that and not pretend about it is another essential part of this. So, of course you're right how to do this, but it's the way to do it that is, you know, the devil's in the details.
Well, to clarify or emphasize a point, the key word you used was disidentify, and the impulses to separate, to make better, to identify with my way is the best way are definitely present, and disidentification simply means that they may be there, but we don't have to act on them, or we don't have to believe them or make them kind of the dominant part of ourselves. And in that sense, that's a necessary goal of practice, really. And as Rob said, the practices that we engage in are specifically intended to allow oneself to be present with all of those kinds of impulses and let them be what they are. And over time, actually, we can educate those parts of ourselves such that they too gain a different perspective on the nature of reality. They're not the enemy, they're just sort of parts of ourselves that are not fully mature. Very much like, as Rob said, you know, often young or new teachers, because of the enthusiasm of their awakening experience, often conflate and say, yes, this is I have the newest, the greatest thing since sliced bread to offer you. And it's not a lie. It's not even necessarily bad in one sense. It's just youthful. You know, it's like when we're young, we're very enthusiastic about things, and when we're young on the path, we get very enthusiastic, and that's okay as long as you can get out of that and not inflict that on people who are studying with you.
So just to follow up on that briefly, so my proposition for your consideration then is that the key here to not be trapped in religious exclusivity, we're going to fall into it, is my assertion. We're going to fall into this tendency because we're human beings. And we make mistakes, and that's exactly how we learn. That's how we learned to walk as babies, by making every mistake you could about how to walk. And we learn in this arena as well by making every mistake you can make, pretty much, at least to some extent. So that's... you know, that's the way we do it, and recognizing that is not a problem. But you need, and this is my assertion for your consideration, for your confirmation in your own practice, we each need to have a methodology or a way or a path to do this, because otherwise the tendency to become lost in identification, and this is something, I'm hardly original saying this, this tendency to become lost in identification is so pervasive, so strong, so of our constituent elements, so a part of that, that we will get lost. That's why we need a tradition. Because the tradition talks to us and says, oh, you're straying over there. Look out. There's a cliff there. You're going to fall if you keep going in that direction. The tradition talks to us. The tradition gives us feedback if it's, and to the extent that it is, a genuine tradition, a living tradition with living exemplars. So that's my response to your question, which is a very good one. Jim.
Part of the problem, as I see it, about religious exclusivity is when there are disagreements, say, in diet, two people disagree about diet, there can be, over time, you know, there can be evidence to bring forth about this disagreement. You know, people can bring forth studies and things like that. Or if mathematicians disagree about some proposition over time, you know, like they can present their disagreements in a way that has a certain objectivity about it. But in the matters of the spirits, there doesn't seem to be a methodology whereby people can sit down and discuss what it is they disagree about and whether or not, you know, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any socially agreed upon way of discussing these differences. And therefore, in diet, I may fall into exclusivity. I may go through exactly the pattern you're talking about. This diet works so well for me. It's the greatest diet. Everybody should try this diet. You know, like, and we've all met people like that. A lot of us have been through that. But because of the ability to present counter-evidence and that sort of thing, it doesn't seem to have the endure or, you know, create the kind of intensity about it that spirituality and religion do. So that's a comment, and if you'd like to comment on that comment.
Well, I agree with partly what you're saying. I think in spiritual traditions, if the practitioners have integrity in their practice, they can talk about these things. And I think there are traditions and teachers who are willing to do that. I mean, that's why I think that, like, our Paiute founder, Robert Innes, willingness to get on stage with other teachers was a willingness not only to, you know, well, it was a willingness to engage in that kind of discussion and to be open to learning something or teaching something, you know, whatever came up. And I think there are people who create that space, but when I think about, you know, what passes for religion and religious disputes, you know, I think about these things like in the history of Christianity, of wars over the interpretation of the Trinity. And, you know, what is that about? I mean, that's something very different is going on there, and then it's just like any other kind of war, you know, the war over ideas, war over I'm right, you're wrong.
I guess my response would be a conversation of the kind of the quality that we're talking about, that Michael referred to, and that you're asking about, is something that has been difficult. We talked about a different kind of conversation, a conversation within a tradition where experienced or senior practitioners have a conversation with less experienced practitioners to help provide feedback, important feedback. And that's one kind of conversation. But because until very recently, spiritual traditions haven't had to rub up against one another, except usually at the point of a scimitar or something like that, we haven't as a species come up with apparently a way to, as you say, a generally agreed upon way to hold the sort of conversations that we can hold within a tradition, between the traditions.
Right now the conversations tend to be conferences and people tend to play nice with each other. You know,
based on the history of religious wars in Europe, in Western Europe and North America, there has developed a social compact where if I don't say what I really think about your religion, you won't say what you really think about my religion, is basically what's developed.
It's not just here. I mean, that's sort of what has kept the Middle East from breaking out into constant warfare.
I suppose that's true, and at times it breaks down.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
So it would appear on that evidence, on the basis of that evidence, that maybe we shouldn't talk to each other about these things. It just seems to be an occasion for more violence, etc. But that's, you know, I'll suggest that that's for your consideration, that that's the short-term perspective. I actually think that over a much longer perspective, the only hope for the development that Jim suggests might happen is, in fact, for more discussion, more frank discussion to happen. Not the constrained discussion that Stuart just referred to, this refusal to be clear. It's a very difficult thing to have an honest discussion where you're being clear about what you're saying and not cast aspersions upon other people. That is a very difficult art. When I was the one challenge that I really enjoyed when I taught at university was in seminars trying to teach students how to do that with one another. It was a great challenge. I was, you know, lecturing is boring, at least for me. And hearing lectures is, you know, depending on the lecturer, can be more or less boring. But the challenge of trying to teach people to learn how to converse with one another in such a way that they are respectful of the possibility that, oh, maybe that person really does know something more than I do. I have to maintain that possibility. But I know that I know something. So how do I create the possibility, the space, such that they can speak and I can actually listen? How do I create the possibility such that when I speak, they can actually hear? This is very difficult. I'd say that that's the essence of the challenge that we have. And the way to approach it is to act as if we already have that in place by doing exactly what we're doing here tonight, as much as we can, by treating each other with the respect that, oh, I have to assume, especially based on my experience, and here's where the maturity thing comes in. My experience has taught me over the years that there are so many arenas where I don't know it all. Where, in fact, what I thought 30 years ago in my hubristic youth must be so. In fact, the exact opposite happens to be the case. These people know something very interesting. And I would do well to listen to it, to hear them out. So, conversation that is just a set piece where no one's listening to the other side won't get us anywhere. But it may be a stage we have to go through to get to, you know, as you know, on we're talking about in broad social stages here. It may be a stage that we have to go through to achieve the kind of genuine conversation that will actually produce what Jim is fond of calling a genuine dialectic, where it's actually possible that you could change my mind by what you tell me. Imagine that. You could actually change my mind. That's a rare thing. But that is the essence, in my view, of spiritual practice. Even more essential, of course, from our perspective, the perspective of our teaching, is what you demonstrate to me, that will really teach me something. How you treat me will really teach me something. How you treat others will really teach me something. That's the conversation that those are the conditions, the context of the conversation that may not seem like much but is actually the essence of the set of factors that can enable this conversation to develop. I don't despair of it. developing. But I don't assume that it's going to happen in my lifetime. I should say the lifetime of this body. Comments, questions? Yes.
All the while we've been talking, sitting on our backsides, I've been thinking how different my experience has been as a student of dance. Mm. And I know when I first started out, I was studying Graham technique, and everybody that was in the group knew that Graham technique was the best. And then Merce Cunningham came along and said, you know, we're not just coming from the solar plexus. And everything that you have said tonight, and even some of your examples where you did all this movement and you did this contraction and everything, it's all there in the form that is inherently ineffable. And we have, you know, especially in improvisation, conversations, in quotes, bodily, and ultimately go to a very spiritual place where the dance dances us, and we're no longer doing the dance. And it seems to me that so much of this intellectualizing is interesting and very good exercise, but it leaves out the body so drastically that it seems to me that we've got to bring the body back rather than just say that that's where it all sort of comes to an end. That it is, in fact, where it all begins. And so I'm glad at the age of 70 I'm still dancing. And I don't want to give it up, because it's one of my highest spiritual experiences, and where I feel I'm in line with and communicating with others, where things happen that I never expected were going to happen. And I can never say I have the right way. I can never say I have the right way. I'm always discovering where to go next, never knowing where that may be. And, well, I just offer that for whatever it's worth, because it's just like, let's get the body really in there somewhere other than as metaphor.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
You know, from the perspective of our tradition, in fact, the body is the place where we have to start focusing our meditative attention.
Right.
And in fact, we do something called Taiyu spirit dance in our tradition, which explicitly involves experimentation with movement of the body and connection with rhythm.
That sounds cool.
But even more fundamentally, when I say that, when I said a moment ago that demonstration is the way we really learn, what I mean by that is precisely that it isn't in words that demonstration occurs. It is in action. It is, and action is, the body is the essence of action.
The embodiment.
Right. So that's you know, that's kind of where we come from in our tradition. But I would you know, in reference to the previous conversation, I can imagine that part of the conversation that Jim suggested, you know, imagined developing in the future, would necessarily have to include the an appreciation for, and even a mutual dialogue of the body to include, to be included in that, to be a part of that. You know, the Sufi turn and Hatha yoga, communicating in a way that they have not previously done, or maybe have only done in some circumstances. There's a tradition called the Bawul Sufis who may have done more about this than many of us recognize. But in any event, these are the sorts of things that are very interesting. I completely agree with you. They're very interesting and of the essence of spiritual practice as I understand it.
Yeah, I wanted to add just a quick acknowledgement. You made a comment that I found very interesting, which is when you're engaged in this exploration through the body, you can't know that you have a right way.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is that, that's when you think about, like, doing Hatha yoga or Sufic dance, as you mentioned, that when you're engaged in those things, the idea of being right or more right than someone doing a completely different set of movements doesn't really arise, because on the realm of the body, right and wrong aren't really relevant. I mean, there's certainly resistance, there's ease, there's smoothness, there's cramps and things like that, but right and wrong don't arise in the same way. It's only when we're engaged in the realm of idea or conceptualizing what it is that we're doing that these boundaries can come into existence. And so bringing the attention back into the body is an interesting way to ground one's practice and to find oneself in a place where the practice is pure enough that the issue really doesn't arise that much as to whether my way is the best way or everyone else is wrong, because it just doesn't, it's not really relevant in that place.
And that's why the great spiritual saints don't embody the pathology of religious exclusivity. Why they can embrace physically as well as emotionally, mentally and spiritually their brethren and sisters from any tradition. And so, and speak to them with the kind of respect and appreciation, while not papering over distinctions. That is, to my mind, the direction to cultivate. It's sort of like what we're talking about doing here is something. At least, there's two levels of it. One is doing our own practice individually more thoroughly, such that we do not or when we fall into the trap of thinking that I've got it now, that we educate ourselves, oops, got that one wrong, that was an error. It's okay to acknowledge error on this level, or that this would be better than that. It's okay to do that. But then there's also this level of this collective, the potential for a collective conversation, which, isn't very well developed, shall we say, at this stage. But that doesn't mean it can't. That does not mean it can't. Just because we haven't doesn't mean we can't do it in the future. And when else are we going to do it? This is the first time, the last 100 years or so, when we've had this, all these different people doing all these different practices, having all these different ideas, up against one another, physically as well as, intellectually and emotionally. So that's the business. That's one business. That's one project that I find very interesting.
One of the things that is intriguing me listening to you, as having a deep love of dance myself, is every spiritual tradition has had a very specific and deep language of movement as a real basic part of their path.
Absolutely. If it's even a small thing for the altar boy that I was, such as genuflection and that sort of thing in the mass, that stuff can be very powerful.
Right, and when you're in a space like that, also with an improv, you also know that it's all about relationship. It's like a piece of sculpture that's fluid and always moving. And part of the, talking about being an altar boy is also your relationship in space to the other people and what they were doing, and then in the larger space,
right,
of everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I actually believe that the next step in evolution is moving from brain-centered language to body-centered language, and that it will incorporate a lot of signing, gesturing, and movement. And a friend of mine once said, "We are alike enough to make communication possible, different enough to make it worthwhile." I want to bring diversity, the word diversity and unity into the conversation, because diversity exists in nature and it's a great mystery, you know. But a tree has to be really, really, really committed to becoming a tree in order for it to become a tree. And it has to almost exclusively. And yet it is functioning, it is becoming. Even while it's in its exclusive mode, it's becoming, according to these laws, these things that are occurring, you know, on the way, way, way unconscious, deep conscious levels that it's not aware of. And it is becoming in relation to everything else, even while it only thinks it's becoming in relation to itself. So, I mean, like now, we have this remarkable diversity of religions in the world. And if the people who evolved those religions hadn't been so committed to the evolution of this particular religion like a work of art while it was in the process of being formulated, then it wouldn't stand now as a part of a rich culture that has all of these different things, these different religions that we can study and then look at the interrelationships between them. So it's like if it weren't for the separation, then we couldn't have the great adventure of encounter. So it's the responsibility of each individual manifestation to become as integral as it possibly can, as unique as it possibly can, and then we enter onto the stage of our encounter, and we get to encounter it as unique and complete and total. But then in the encounter, something new emerges.
Well, that's the part. Thank you. That's the part that I would focus on. I have no idea what the kind of conversation that we've just been discussing might produce in 500 years or 1,000 years, assuming that we're still alive in that time period. So, but if that's true, then my guess is that a conversation such as we're describing would, as life does, produce entirely new forms and manifestations, and that would be interesting. So that would be my response. Any other comments or questions? Yeah.
I think it's important, okay, in whatever tradition you happen to be in, I think it's important to sort of acknowledge its dark side.
Okay.
I was when we were in the Buddhist tradition, I was, you know, very idealistic about it. And then after a while, I began to see, you know, the dark side of Tibetan Buddhism. People think that Tibet was Shangri-La, and a lot of Tibet was the Wild West. And there was a lot of rivalry and suppressing of different traditions and things like that. I mean, even within any tradition, that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I even think the idea of tolerance can have a dark side.
Absolutely.
You know, you can be intolerant of people who don't practice your brand of tolerance. You know, the culture wars, if you really read into that, you can see that, you know, liberals are as capable of being narrow-minded and bigoted and doing dirty politics as, you know, the religious right.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, I think that's a perfectly valid that, you know, every traditions are the creations of human beings, and the often with spiritual traditions, the genius that gives rise to an initial expression of a tradition gets kind of crystallized into a form that ideally carries that tradition forward. And I think of it as a cup, you know, that's filled with a sacred fluid. Sometimes the cup is emptied, and there's this cup that just goes on through time. And every now and then, I think like the Catholic Church, you know, that there was this empty cup for a while, and then all of a sudden the St. Francis sort of appeared and filled it for a period of time, and, you know, maybe it got spilled again. But, you know, the rivalries and the dark side tend to be more about, you know, the structure of the cup and people holding on to a crystallized form of a tradition when they forget the spontaneity that gave rise to that tradition in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's for us, the knowing that and acknowledging that dark side is an important reminder to, you know, recognize, oh, it's not about that. It's not about the rivalry of particular sects. It's about something else that was originally pointed to by those traditions. And if we keep reminding ourselves of that without flinching, we can find ourselves in a better place with which to actually partake of what that cup was originally meant to hold. So it's good. I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge those things. That's partly, you know, at the beginning when I was talking about the Fourth Way tradition, you know, a tradition that's been very important in my own practice. You know, I'm very clear about the dark side of it, because there is a dark side of it. Every tradition has strengths and weaknesses, and they're not all the same. They're not all cut out of the same mold. And knowing that, our practice can become stronger.
Well, I guess a lot may not be exactly along these lines, but the one sort of idea that's real popular right now that kind of makes me crazy is that all paths lead to the same thing. It makes me absolutely bonkers.
Right. What was it that Kathy says about the many rivers? The many rivers all flow to the ocean, but you know, some of them dry up along the way.
Some of them lead to the Dead Sea.
Right. No, but that's a great point, because you know, that's one of those things that annoys me, kind of like there is no path. It's one of those kind of New Age kind of flip, you know, commentaries that don't have any meaning, because there are differences between practices, and that doesn't necessarily. And I think there an argument can be made, a reasonable argument, as Jim was saying, that some practices may be more effective for more people than other practices. But you know, you can never know for sure, I find it hard to make judgments against other traditions without, like, investing myself in the tradition for long enough to actually know what it's about. But yeah, I don't think they're the same. I think they're, and you know, to get to, you know, back to Michael's point, I think part that's what makes it wonderful. That's what to have so many different traditions. There is the possibility of interesting conversations and interesting unions and compositions and something new coming out of this conglomeration of all these traditions touching each other. So in that sense, it's very exciting. But as Rob said, I have no idea what form that's going to take.
If we're still alive.
If we're still alive.
If we're still alive.
So on that
happy
positive note.
Right.
Any final comments or questions? Observations?
I think this is a great conversation. Great evening.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
We've certainly enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for coming tonight and participating. And I hope that you'll have more of these kinds of topics in the future. Many liberators for Kunti has adopted the custom of dana, or generosity. There is a donation bowl on the counter, and a portion of the donation goes to the Rotary Meditation Center to support their work, and a portion goes to the store so that we can continue to have these events on Thursday evening.
So not all donations are the same, and some donations are better than others.
Bigger donations are better.
Meditate on that on your way out.